The chiefless Irishman, Mark Carney, has owned us in the election. Tabernacle, guys!
He has raised the price of the stinking cheese by 0.5%. And we are on our way to the Beaver Depot with the grenade launchers to overthrow the government.
I don't understand why nobody takes the Quebecois seriously, huh? We are out here fighting for our freedom against Mark Carney. Vive le Québec libre!
I'd just like to preemptively apologize to all of our Canadian listeners and anyone with ears.
No, just the Quebecois ones. The rest of Canada will love that.
Well, that's what the second clause was for, George, because I feel like people with ears are now going to be deeply affronted. Like me.
This is Normal Men, a podcast from four men who are clinging desperately to normalcy in an era when that's asking a bit too much. I'm George in Charlotte.
This is Proctor Malone in Washington, D.C.
I'm low-tech speedrun enjoyer in outer Florida.
I'm Ed from Boston.
Welcome to Normal Men, where we're tracking sovereign citizen activity north of the border this week. To start, we had an absolutely incredible and, I mean, honestly, a little scary, but the RCMP was on it, so the Mounties got on it, so we can make jokes about it. Absolutely incredible situation in Quebec where Canadian Armed Forces personnel stole weapons from their base. Put that Diet Pepsi down, you Boston redheaded freak. Stole Armed Forces ordnance off their base and were trying to set up a militia to, I don't know, overthrow Ottawa or something. It didn't work, suffice to say. Mostly because the Quebecois were involved, but also because the Mounties did their jobs.
Most competent French military operation.
So that's your laugh about militia activity this week. We don't get a lot of that. We don't get a lot of that to talk about. That's funny. Most of it's just terrifying. But when it's happening in Quebec instead of Idaho, you can get some good yucks out of it. Exactly.
I believe in the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. Maybe in a way that I don't believe in the FBI right now.
I don't think that's saying much, brother.
Yeah, that bar is in hell. I mean, like what? Cash Patel's not running it, and Dan Boingo. So I mean, it ought to be pretty smooth sailing up there.
So we thought this week we would start off with some big picture stuff rather than getting into the minutiae of the news. And one of the things that the normal men collectively hold dear is equality as a political precept, that this is something that it is good to pursue, economic equality in particular, other types of equality also. As
shout out to materialist Gnostic at Walmsley, Walmsley, .bscot.social, who observed that the reason to tax the rich is that allowing unlimited accumulation of wealth is enormously politically toxic, not that Bill Gates's fortune is the reason you have to shell out for a deductible when you get a colonoscopy. So there are things about the US political economy that are informed by the mass concentration of income at the high end of the income distribution. But the US economy is so large and the material standard of living is so high that even if you just concentrated on the wealthiest people with the absolutely unimaginable levels of income and wealth at that part of the distribution, that in itself is not enough to provide a high material standard of living for everybody in society. You could improve a lot of people's lives, but it wouldn't be enough to, for instance, finance a universal healthcare system or something like that, which I think speaks to the perception of the US income distribution as opposed to the reality of it, which is the perception is that the median family makes $30,000 a year and five people make $175 trillion a year or something like that. And it's just not true. I mean, the median household income is over $80,000 a year. There's an enormous amount of wealth in this country that's not at all concentrated at the top end. But just because it's true that you couldn't redistribute the very top end of the income distribution to pay for a high standard of living for everybody doesn't mean you shouldn't do it. And there are other reasons as well as basic wanting to make society more fair to do it, or other reasons on top of attacking that political economy of a few people having concentrated power. One of those reasons is economic growth. If you have highly skewed income distributions, that means a lot of people who want to spend a lot more money don't have the money to do it. And if you give them money, they'll spend more of it. Even if you're not transferring it just from the wealthiest, even if you're transferring it from the people who are wealthier than 75% or higher income than 75% of people, whatever your cutoff is, those dollars get spent at a faster rate, the economy grows faster. So this isn't always true, and we can talk about why that's maybe the case later, but in general, being in favor of a more equitable distribution of income than we currently have, to a point, which we're very far from, is being pro-economic growth. And being opposed to that is being anti-economic growth. It's just straightforward.
Right. So generally consumption drives immediate growth. And as you go down the income ladder, marginal propensity to consume is higher.
And marginal propensity to consume just means the amount of spending you do given a dollar of new income. So for instance, an MPC of one means you earn another dollar, you spend another dollar. Very straightforward. Parts of the U.S. income distribution have MPCs over one, which means you give them a dollar of new income, they spend $1.20 because they leverage it, which is bad financial advice, but dynamite for economic growth. And that's what we saw in 2021, 2022. We saw massive transfers by American standards to low-income households. Bernie Sanders, for instance, going to the mat in 2020 to get the expanded, the super dole is what it later got called, but the expanded unemployment insurance benefits. That was massively, massively beneficial to the lowest earners because they were talking in round dollar numbers as opposed to percentage of income or something like that. And that's why inflation got so high. There's other reasons too, but demand was really strong. People had lots of money to spend. Not as true now, but certainly was earlier on.
There's also kind of an interesting, I guess it's more of a thought experiment than it is an observed phenomenon. But for anything where you have for any production function where you have economies of scale, where it's easier to produce things at scale than it is to produce things individually, which it turns out is not everything, but almost everything besides certain types of services. If you flatten the income distribution, if you make it so that there's more equality, you can wind up actually increasing people's utility for a lesser amount of income, because you're going to be getting more in terms of what you actually care about, right? Like income is what we use to measure a utility function, because it's measurable, and utility is not measurable and is not easily comparable between people. But what you actually care about is the bang you get for your buck.
Economies of scale just means the more of something you make, the cheaper per unit it is. So for instance, if you make 1 million iPhones, they're going to cost a lot less per iPhone than if you make one, right? Utility, again, it's unknowable. We can't actually measure it. But what we can say is that for someone who wants a given set of goods and services, if more people want or have access to or are in the market for those goods and services, then you're going to get more access to those goods and services than you would otherwise.
If you have a city that has a bunch of millionaires, you're going to have pretty good restaurants in that city. You're going to have a well-heeled customer base that is interested in eating out a lot. They're going to spend a lot of money at restaurants. You're going to attract good restaurateurs. You're going to attract good chefs. You're going to attract infrastructure that brings in good ingredients. Everybody's going to eat pretty well, at least at, you know, that top broad slice of the income distribution. If you have that same total amount of money, but it's flipped around into one extremely, extremely rich person and commensurately fewer people that are kind of in that wealthy upper middle bracket, you're not going to get those restaurants because the extremely rich person can only eat one place at once. They can hire a private chef, and that might maybe mean that they eat as well as they would in the dense consumer model. But it may also be that they eat worse than they would if they were poorer, comparatively still very rich, but in a city that had a broader consumer base that supported the kind of things that they wanted to buy. And George mentioned iPhones a minute ago. You also get some pretty extreme network effects on some of these things, where you have things that are enabled by network effects, that only exist if there are enough consumers who can get over whatever the gating price is to get into the network. The internet is a much poorer place if fewer people have access to it. You know, if the internet is a place that you have to make $1 million a year to log on to, there's not much internet. Whereas if the internet is something that is freely accessible to many people, you get all the cat photos you want.
Most technology improvements of the last 30, 40 years, probably longer, but you know, I wasn't there, can really be attributed to being able to chase a larger consumer base, right? Like the iPhone is a good example, but it goes past that, right? I recently fell down a vintage camera hole, and it's not exactly because of the relentless march of time that all of that stuff has gotten better, cheaper, and is capable of recording 6K on the moon. It's because people wanted to buy it, right? And while that particular industry has gotten a little weird, thanks again, iPhone, there's definitely been substantial improvements in just things like optics, things like recording capabilities, just because more people are able to afford it.
Right. And you see this in markets like automotive markets, where there's a big difference between making a mass market car and making a luxury car that only a few people will be able to afford. And the mass market cars are very good. Are they as good as, you know, the $500,000 supercars? Well, no, you'd probably rather have the $500,000 supercar, but there's not $450,000 worth of difference there.
I mean, I don't know. Have you seen $500,000 cars? Like, they're usually British or Italian, and that's not generally a great recipe for good automaking. I say that just having owned them before. Not $500,000 ones, but I've owned a Fiat.
The resident nerds have talked a lot about marginal propensity to consume, and we probably should at some point have a section about those folks who are over one, because for my sins, I have been adjacent to the buy now, pay later industry, and it's gross. But the other big problem, aside from just having an economy that works, is what we're seeing now around political power being able to concentrate based on what you can buy, right? And that applies both to rich individuals. Hi, Elon Musk, don't do the voice. But also businesses, right? Like having Disney own ABC probably has some impacts on what sort of framing you have around the importance of the movie industry to the American economy or whatever.
Yeah, this is one of the reasons that one of the best things that Biden did in his term was give Lena Khan a Gundam thought. And I really can't emphasize enough how missing that, and not everyone missed that, but missing that was a huge whiff for the left, because her whole deal is attacking concentrations of power that capital creates in the political arena. Even if it's indirectly, she wasn't trying to overturn Citizens United, but she was attacking the concentrations of power within industries that allow the sorts of craziness we've seen unleashed by that particular Supreme Court decision, which basically said money is speech and that's it. You can't restrict it. It's also an interesting thing where you have an intersection of bad economics and bad political institutional design in the United States specifically, because I think this is a theme we keep coming back to on this podcast, where it's not just, oh, we have an economically powerful entity that's misbehaving. It's doing that because our political infrastructure doesn't work properly. There's no good feedback to get in the way of that, because we have the Supreme Court in this instance. In other instances, it's the filibuster. In other instances, it's gerrymandering and other, you know, whatever down the line, getting in the way and preventing the feedback through electoral politics.
Turns out having V1 democracy has its downsides.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is not exclusively a subnational problem. This is an international problem. Because if you have very high concentrations of wealth anywhere, as we've seen in recent years, we've seen this with Russian and Middle Eastern oil money. It's mostly petrodollars, because that tends to be where the really, really high differential, the really, really high wealth concentrations happen. We've seen that money come in and knock British democracy sideways, we've seen it have a fairly deleterious effect on U.S. democracy, despite what Tulsi Gabbard has been saying in the last few days.
I will say, though, you know, Elon tried to go after British democracy and ran into the cult of Nigel. So that was, I was actually cheering that one.
Yeah, that doesn't end well. It shows up in the weirdest places, too, because some of our intrepid listeners probably know that I used to do esports stuff. And when they were not buying golf, KSA and related entities decided to try to buy video games. And unlike golf, they kind of succeeded, right? For a few years there, they were bankrolling pretty much everything that you could find in the esports space to a really, really delightful extent. You know, folks with pride flags going to Saudi Arabia to commentate events was a mood. But it's just weird. Like, the money has nowhere else to go to get that sort of whitewashing of international reputation. So it gets into the weirdest places.
And that brings us back to the UK, because the English Premier League, which is the top, the best single national soccer league in the entire world, but and not close, is basically sustained by petrodollars at this point. There are clubs that are not awash in that kind of investment, but it's an incredibly important plank in the economics of the EPL. And if you're interested in this, you should definitely go listen to the Double Pivot podcast hosted by my friends Michael Cayley and Michael Goodman. They go into it. So that's a whole separate cranny to crawl into, where you're not just talking about direct political power in terms of an electoral democracy. Saudi oil money isn't bankrolling reform, as far as I know, but it is having an enormous impact on UK culture and soft power, because they are very important, very, very important for one of the most important cultural exports the UK has left.
The UK also has a bunch of distortive effects that are essentially linked to money laundering through, it's primarily London real estate, but it's kind of taken over a good chunk of the UK economy. And, you know, we're seeing the same thing happen to the United States through both real estate and through the crypto portal. If you have these really, really high concentrations of wealth, that creates soft power in the way that, in a way that's kind of analogous to what we've thrown away with USAID, that you have these international benefactors, and they're not all trying to be malicious. They're not all criminals. They're not all trying to do things that are untoward. We have the Children's Hospital in DC is funded by oil money, and that's great, even if the motives behind it are whatever they are. But you have these kind of gravity wells that surround that sort of concentration of wealth that are distortive of everything else that comes near them, that you see institutions bend to where the money is.
Hard to come up with a better example than crypto in the American context or anywhere else, right? It's entirely a vote buying scheme. The only reason we have a stablecoin bill coming out of the U.S. Senate last week and Senate House signed into law is because they bought votes, straightforwardly. And it's less obvious on the Republican side. I'm not actually sure that a bunch of nihilists would be opposed to increasing the role of crypto in society, you know, without being paid to do so. But certainly on the Democratic side, there is no reason a Democrat should be supporting anything to do with the crypto industry. The only reason is they're getting cut checks. Straightforward. That's it. It's money.
Yeah, Republicans will just do it for free.
Yeah, I think we haven't really fully seen the might of the crypto Death Star. You know, crypto was the single largest lobby by a large margin this last electoral cycle. And everyone's current expectation is that in 2026, they will again be the single largest lobby by a gigantic margin. We're talking tens, possibly $100 million more than what oil and gas is spending. It's jaw-dropping the amount of money that crypto is throwing into campaigns. And they're getting results for it. They're getting law and policy that matches what they want.
Looking at you, Ruben Gallego.
Yeah, bring the Saudis back.
You know, like, I mean, it's Gallego, but it's not just Gallego. There was a vote a while back that I went through and I looked at the year of first election for every Democratic senator that voted for it. And it was everybody who was new to the Senate after, I want to say, 2014 was on the crypto side of it. And, you know, there were also a few of the old guard who were on the crypto side. But basically, if you've come to politics relatively recently at the national level, at the senatorial level, you are awash in crypto money. And again, like, the crypto money is not necessarily inherently bad, except insofar as it has this gravitational effect.
No, as the resident financial markets professional, nope. I'm going to take the other side of that particular comment.
Also bad.
Yeah. Like, the case for crypto is the same. The positive case for crypto is the same as the positive case for Uber. Yeah, great. We can provide a bunch of new transportation options to people. The only reason we're able to do that is because we're end-running regulation. That's it. Mm-hmm. We are a scam product that exists only because the United States is surrendering the power over minting currency to us. That's it. Right. That's literally everything else is noise. That's it. So if you have a slice of that power to mint currency and you can just issue securities with no regulation whatsoever, then yeah, you're going to be worth a lot, but you're not actually doing anything other than just getting rid of regulation.
Yeah. And I was going to say, Uber does at least like give you a ride to the airport.
Sometimes.
Usually.
Crypto. What is the analog for crypto there?
Defrauding you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like you get to hold in one hand huge gains and in the other hand getting your face ripped off in an obvious scam. And sometimes they look identical. And like.
Right.
You know, obviously, like, curious game, smartest move seems to be not to play, but still they're accumulating enormous value because there are an almost endless string of rubes in this world to fleece money out of. And the only reason I need to be really clear about this. The only reason the crypto industry exists is because it wasn't crushed under the boot in about 2014 or 2016.
Yep.
It absolutely could and should have been. It should have been illegal to transfer any US dollars through the traditional banking system to a crypto exchange. It would have gone to zero. We would never heard about it again. The US government opened the door to crypto being a thing, and it's why it is where it is today. Full stop.
They probably thought it would fall apart on its own. Because there is no rationale for it.
That's the charitable explanation. There are others.
A lot of the crypto gains are related to evading other countries' capital control regimes, right? So, like, I mean, they also get around our regulations, but they get around other people's regulations as well. So to some extent, I think that was the argument for crypto, is that this unlocks some amount of capital value that's sitting in China, that's sitting in Russia, and puts it in a place where markets can get. Now, that's both laudatory and derogatory, right? Like, I am literally describing money laundering here, but
it has, like, other wonderful effects too.
Anyway, in terms of the political gravity of this stuff, it's a problem, and it's possible it's the problem for American politics right now. We're going to be working through it for a while. This looks different than corporate power. This looks very different than corporate power, and the ways in which it looks different in corporate power tends to be more personalistic. It lends itself better to an authoritarian regime, perhaps, than corporate power does. You have individuals who can be co-opted by a personalist or authoritarian regime in a way that corporations create a separate center of gravity, a separate center of power. And I think that, you know, this is going to be the task of the rest of our political lives, is to figure out how to either fight this stuff or reroute it so that it's not as destructive.
They're calling it the dumbest unraveling of a presidency in history, folks. And you really hear it more and more.
I have been aware of the Epstein stuff since, I don't even know, like, it's a decade, whatever, at this point. I have been aware of Donald Trump's involvement with Epstein for roughly as long, right? I mean, I am pretty sure TruAnon, which, if you really want to get into the Epstein stuff, there's a whole podcast. TruAnon's your go-to for this. I can't say it won't break your brain a bit, but it's out there.
It's apparently hilarious. I've never listened.
Brace and Liz are, it's a specific kind of humor, but if you like the kind of humor, they're very funny. Anyhow, so I had no thought in my mind that this would ever land in any way, because I just assumed that it was out there and people knew and that was it, and they were just going to choose to ignore it. But it turns out that large sections of the right-wing elites in this country, of MAGA elites, not even right-wing elites, just MAGA elites, apparently had no idea that he was connected to Epstein, that this is new information for them.
What gets me is that for 8 years, I have just been, cool, this is Facebook gas leak stuff. And then the gas leak reaches us. And I'm dying.
What I can't get over is that they campaigned on this.
Twice.
Like, no one on the Democrat side, no one on the Democratic side was talking about Epstein. We all knew that Trump was connected to Epstein. We didn't know if he had done anything wrong. Didn't know anything about it. And I think the four of us probably didn't give the Epstein stuff really all that much thought. And yet the right campaigned on this. They said, we're going to get into office. We're going to release the client list. We're going to do all this bullshit. And then Trump decided, or first the FBI and Pam Bondi decided that they had the client list. It was on her desk for review. She said this. And then a few days later, the FBI comes out and says there was no client list. And the online right especially went nuts. And Trump began telling people, you know, Epstein doesn't matter. I never knew him. I've never wrote a picture in my life. And they, like, half the online right has now seemingly turned on Trump for this. And it's fantastic because it's a complete own goal. Like, no one cared on the left.
It's such a perfect encapsulation of Trump's martingale political strategies, right? He throws everything he can at the wall to see what sticks. And then if something slides off and lands on his coat, he just throws it back at the wall, right? Like, he just keeps doubling down, keeps doubling down, keeps doubling down. It's the same thing Elon does exactly in right. business, right? Like, it's exactly the same strategy. It's, if you're in trouble, throw more leverage at it. And in, I said martingaling, let me define that. So a martingale is a specific strategy at a casino. You walk in, you bet a dollar on roulette. If you win, you bet the same dollar. If you lose, you bet $2. If you lose that, you bet $4. If you lose that, you bet $8, so on and so forth. And the theory is eventually you're going to double your money on your payout, and that will wipe out the series of losses that got you to that point. Of course, this doesn't work in reality because casinos will come in and say you're not allowed to do that, which probably a good thing, because also the casino has more money than you do. So as you keep scaling those bets up, eventually you hit a number where you don't have that money anymore and you're done. It's very low probability, but it statistically must happen eventually, right? So if you're using this strategy, eventually something's going to go wrong, or you die first, which, of natural causes, or an assassin's bullet that was just a centimeter closer to target. Either way, eventually, if you keep doing this long enough, it will blow up in your face. And maybe the Epstein stuff is what is the martingale that's finally blowing up in Trump's face after he tried to put that keep doubling down, poof, maybe not.
So I don't know if any of you here listen to the Knowledge Fight podcast, though. The awkward edit that I'm going to scrub out of this suggests no one has. But they have a section called Formulaic Objections, where they go over a deposition from one of Alex Jones's several hilarious and evil lawsuits. And Jones was deposed in one of them, and I seem to recall he actually said something about Epstein didn't kill himself in one of those depositions. And then now in the last 2 weeks, we have him crying on his short form media of choice about how this is the worst thing you could do to this guts the FBI, whatever other nonsense comes out of his mouth. And like, yeah, if he's going to believe it. Yeah. I mean, he believes whatever is convenient for him at any given time. But like, there's also a lot of other people in that circle. And some of them are doing it for the grift and some of them are doing it for the love of the game. And I really kind of think we might have slept on this a little bit.
You can tell which ones too are actually have like the Washington connections, and they know their bread is buttered on that side. versus the ones like, you know, Nick Fuentes, who, you know, just lives off his YouTube channel. Like, I don't think any of these people really believe in any of this shit.
I think some of them are crazy enough. I really do.
I mean, some probably are, but I don't think any of these big name guys are. I don't think Charlie Kirk is. I don't think Nick Fuentes is. But you can tell who's got the establishment ins and who is, you know, one of the fringe guys who's got to make their bones on YouTube or TikTok or any of these stuff based upon how they're reacting to this. Like, oh, Trump says we got to let it go, so we let it go. Or Trump says we got to let it go. No, we were serious about this. You need to put that list out.
But now what list are they going to put out, right? Are they going to put out a list without Trump's name on it? Because they all think he's on it now.
Well, so that's the big question, right? Like we've got reports that DOJ used 1,000 FBI agents to spend at least tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of man hours reviewing a large number of records back in March. What do we think is in those records? What do we think is in the files?
Recipes.
Nothing good for Trump. There is no question he was very socially close with a guy who is running a sex trafficking operation. That is not up for debate, right? That's media reports at the time, pictures it together, it goes on. I mean, he's on the flight logs. Like, it's not up for dispute. It can only get worse from there, right?
Right.
Yeah, I mean, Epstein comes across, you know, in the letter that was published for Epstein's 50th birthday book binder thing. You know, Epstein and Trump come across as like, Epstein comes across as like Trump's closest friend, almost, you know, someone that Trump is actually close to, actually admires, actually cares about, which is a very strange thing with Donald Trump.
Yeah, and I think you have to remember that this was from a time period where things were not going particularly well for Trump financially.
Right.
You know, Trump was, I believe, in between a couple of the associated bankruptcies. He was on a short leash from the Trump org. You know, Epstein was the high roller in that relationship at that point. Trump had the name, but Epstein had the money. Given that the locus for this is apparently the Southern District of New York, it seems likely to me that at least a good chunk of what's being gone through here are effects from Epstein's New York property. That these are things that came out of, I don't know if it was an apartment or where he was living, but when they broke that down, whatever they found went into boxes. And you know, there was some back and forth on Blue Sky and elsewhere about this, but one interesting question is how far DOJ got back in 2019 after the Epstein arrest on cataloging and digitizing and going through all these many, many, many records to figure out what was there. It could be that this is all still mostly paper, that these are mostly physical properties. That would tend to be kind of in concordance with the reports that they were having agents work around the clock, work shifts for 24 hours.
Should we believe those reports, by the way? I mean, should we just assume that because Kash Patel said they were, that they were actually dedicating that much time? Or,
well, to be clear, that the source on that is Dick Durbin. It's not Kash Patel.
Ah, okay. So Dick Durbin hearing it from the FBI.
It's Dick Durbin hearing it from somebody who we assume is the FBI.
Okay.
But
I'm just throwing it out there that the FBI could be putting a shine on there.
Sure, absolutely. And you know, like, I mean, the New York FBI kind of got us into this whole mess back with Anthony Weiner, right? Like they leak constantly. I'm a little bit skeptical of some of the game of telephone that's clearly happening here between people who are involved in the operation but weren't core to it, who are now talking to Democratic senators and probably a lot of other people about what they saw because they see some opportunity here. I think it's a really interesting question who it is that's talking and why they're talking now, but I'm not sure we're going to get good answers to that question until, you know, the history of this is written in a couple of years.
Suspect it might be more than a couple.
Yeah, I mean, so far, whoever it is wants to keep their name out of the papers, right? Like,
for sure.
My wild ass speculation here is that they canned some of the people at DOJ that they maybe shouldn't have canned, who are now either angry enough or vengeful enough or whatever to go weak about this stuff because they're no longer associated with the FBI.
I think it's J.D. Vance. He's trying to undermine...
Worst betrayal ever.
He's betraying Mr. Trump and his beautiful movement so that he can turn the White House back over to the globalists.
I mean, we don't need to get into the conspiracy of why J.D. Vance just went to, was it Montana? I forget where.
Montana.
Yeah.
The Murdochs have their compound.
Is that a conspiracy or is he just going to yell at Rupert? Which, by the way, can you imagine the look? Well, can you imagine the look on Rupert Murdoch, who's like 96 years old and is just not. I mean, you can't touch this guy. You can't. There's nothing the Trump administration can do because he's 96 years old. He doesn't care. He doesn't care. Nobody who's 96 cares about this stuff, right? So you got J.D. Vance, who's already one of the most pathetic visages in American politics, coming in to get all mad at you about a goddamn article in the Wall Street Journal. And can you imagine trying to keep a straight face with that guy yipping at you about it? It would be comical.
He's just sighing heavily and just going like, arr-nar.
These are not serious people.
you need to work an Australian accent into that next time. We'll come back to you.
I tried to do it, but.
And I mean, by the way, Team Murdoch did not support J.D. Vance as the vice presidential candidate. They were all in on Doug Burgum.
To be clear, Rupert Murdoch is a terrible human being, and I will not miss him departing this plane of existence one bit.
Nope, he gets the Kissinger.
Oh, yeah, he gets the Kissinger. But when someone's in their mid-90s, there's just only so much you can do to squeeze them.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that in terms of, like, the Murdoch v. Trump aspects of this, so to give a little background on this, the big story that broke about this broke in the Wall Street Journal. Which I love it, hate it, good business paper, terrible opinion page, but it's a Murdoch property. It has functioned as a Murdoch property for many years in terms of its opinion page, in terms of the ideas it's putting out there. It has been a mouthpiece for the Murdoch empire. It was the Wall Street Journal that broke this story. And we are at a time of transition for the Murdoch empire because the heirs to the Murdoch empire do not necessarily see eye to eye on how to approach American conservatism. You have the two brothers, Lachlan Murdoch and James Murdoch, who, from all accounts, don't like each other very much. Neither one is what I would describe as a liberal in any way. But, you know, Lachlan is much more in his father's mold, and James is maybe a little bit more open to non-movement conservatism. Is that fair to say?
I always heard that the other siblings were rather more liberal than Lachlan, the one who has been given the nod to date, but I could be wrong about that.
Yeah, I've heard that James that Rupert has been like moving the inheritance to the other kids because he doesn't want James taking over a bunch of the properties. I don't know how true that is, but I've read that.
So there was litigation on this that hit at least one significant result point in, I believe it was last December, that was the bad result for Lachlan, the good result for the world. The determination, at least at that stage, was that they wouldn't be able to rewrite the trust and rewrite the wills in such a way that Lachlan wound up running the empire. Whether that holds through the appeal process, I don't know.
Yeah, so looking at Open Secrets, apparently James R. and Catherine A. Murdoch have donated $11 million directly to Democratic causes and zero to Republicans, so...
Ding, 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 ding.
Their chips might be down.
They're libbing out, folks. The Murdoch heirs are libbing out.
They're shit libs now.
Yeah, it's amazing, too, how much this Murdoch drama mirrors and is following the arc of Succession, right? Obviously, Succession was largely based on the Murdoch family drama itself, but it's both life imitating art and art imitating life at this point. It's like back and forth. They're in discussion with one another, which is bananas. Really impressive stuff from the showrunners there.
I'm going to just nod knowingly. And
you haven't seen Succession? With your sense of humor, dude, you would love it. You would love... Oh, God. Stop taking your pictures and walking your dog and watch you some Succession.
Your dog will also like Succession.
She has better taste than me.
And let us know when you get to the episode with hyper decanting, because that's one of my favorite scenes in television.
I suppose we would be remiss not to point out that all of the last several minutes of discussion really ties in neatly to this whole preventing of power consolidation thing, maybe. I don't know. Might be a good idea.
Totally.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely the media channel is one of the major risks for that kind of political power consolidation. Right. But, you know, it's kind of hard to actually run that. It's propaganda is not easy to do. Even if you have a bunch of money to throw at media outlets, it's not always easy to get the result you want from the body politic through what you're putting out through those media outlets. And lots of people in lots of places have screwed that up. Rupert Murdoch has been very successful doing it.
Yeah. It's also worth noting that the Trump administration, the effort to consolidate power for the Trump administration has been far more invested in negative propaganda than positive propaganda. What I mean by that is muzzling speech as opposed to pushing speech out through traditional media outlets. So we can have a conversation about whether Stephen Colbert got fired because his show was losing a bunch of money or because Trump didn't like him. But there's other stuff that's happened at CBS that suggests that they are very willing to be squeezed if it means their merger can go through. Similar stuff with universities, similar stuff. I mean, it just, there's a laundry list of this stuff. So you can create a knowledge or information vacuum if you're the Trump administration, but that opens you up to Glonzo. It really opens you up to Glonzo. And that brings us back to Epstein, right? Because you can't get more Glonzo than Epstein. I mean, I do think there is some fire there as opposed to just the pure smoke that would be Glonzo, but
Glonzo has become visible and is hanging from the power lines.
And just a quick reminder, Glonzo is the invisible monster that feeds on power lines that 25% of the population believes in. And if 25% of the population believes in Glonzo, you had better have a solution to Glonzo as a politician. Whether or not you're aware that Glonzo is fictional, you need to have some kind of plan for Glonzo. The thought on Glonzo is that Glonzo issues, these imaginary issues, whether it's immigrant caravans or whether it's the literal UFOs off the New Jersey coast that everybody swore they saw, or
die in snack foods for crying out loud.
Yeah. You know, the Ebola epidemic that wasn't in Texas a few years ago, that these issues almost always work to the benefit of the crazier faction. Trump in particular is able to leverage Glonzo issues in a way that a Biden or an Obama, for that matter, are not able to, because we're the serious party. Trump is able to say, you know, under me, I will send in the Marines to kill Glonzo. And we can't say that because Glonzo doesn't exist. So, sorry, brief aside, just to remind everyone about Glonzo.
This brief aside was 78 seconds long.
I would just add that Mexican Coke is also a Glonzo.
Oh, stop it.
No, you know what? You know what I like, though, is that so now we have people in actual power calling for Trump now to release the files. We had Kash Patel and Dan Boingo, who were apparently threatening to resign if Bondi did not turn over the files. And then we had Mike Johnson come out and say, you know, well, I think he should release all these files.
I do declare.
So this is becoming like a real thing. I cannot believe how stupid this is. But I am fully on board with, I don't want the Democrats to be like pounding the table on it every day, but I do want them to just like jam the knife in a little bit, keep it on the radar and keep them freaking out about it. But otherwise, just let them go nuts on each other.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think it's something the Democratic politicians necessarily need to be talking about, because this is a train that's rolling with them or without them.
The more they talk about it, the more likely right wing is to get the one, you know, one spark across their two neurons they're all time sharing that, like, maybe they should stop.
I do think the perfect place for it is in a congressional hearing or something like that, or in a debate or whatever, as a one-liner. Don't hold press conferences on it, but just anytime there's some nonsense out there, like, where are those Epstein files at? You know, like, look, over there, a squirrel. Because the entire megasphere is literally on the level of squirrel, and you'll get some returns from that, even if it doesn't lead to a collapse of the Trump administration, which, to be clear, I still think is at least possible. I mean, if they do a bad job redacting those files, and nothing would surprise me less, then
I don't think they can do a good job redacting those files. Like I don't think there's any redaction job they can do where they put out any meaningful amount of Epstein records that subdue this, because it's Guanzo, right? Because this is partially conspiracy theory, because this is partially a very, very vivid set of things for which people are kind of filling in the gaps. Anything that they take out of that is going to be illustrated by some very vivid imaginations. They might even be right in what they fill in. They might even be right in what they interpolate. But gaps are not going to be taken as just, okay, well, I guess we don't have that information. People are going to speculate. And even if they were to release every page they have in full text, people would speculate that they had not released every page they had.
And also, to be clear, they cannot release every page they have in full text and do anything but fuel significant association between Trump and Epstein.
Right.
There's no way that you can, he's all over it. I'm not alleging he did anything criminal with regards to Epstein, because I don't know, but he's going to be a name that shows up again and again and again in those files.
Even once would be enough.
I'm alleging he did stuff that was criminal. Like, come on.
And that's why I'm married to an attorney and you're not.
I don't care if it's true or not. I still think we should allege it.
We should certainly ask the question.
We're just asking questions. It's fine.
We're just asking questions. That's right.
All right. Let's move on before Lotex puts all the elements of actual malice into one sentence.
So I'm really disappointed now, guys. And I'll tell you why. Because as Propter astutely mentioned, or maybe it was George, I don't know, I wasn't really listening. a lot of this seems to be coming out of the Southern District of New York. And I was like, oh, sweet, this is a great segue into the next block. And then I find out that Brooklyn, the district of one Hakeem Jeffries, is in the Eastern District of New York. So my joke about how all things from the Southern District of New York need to be banned from public conversation no longer works. So talk amongst yourselves.
Which is why we just need to ban New York from political discussions altogether.
Connecticut, yep. Too.
Yep. Yep. You can vote, but we're not going to talk about it. And you're certainly not going to be allowed to do anything as an elected representative from those states. You can vote, and that's it.
You start complaining, more. And then we say, look, we let you vote. You could be D.C.
Yep.
Shut up.
And I know New Yorkers are going to say, yeah, but we gave you AOC. We're moving AOC to Wisconsin for a couple years so that we can count her as a Midwesterner, because Democrats from the Midwest are pretty much unbeatable based on a sample size of like two.
Instead of showing up to union picket lines in Tim's with Bustelo, she's going to be showing up to union picket lines with big piles of cheese curds and Wisconsin old fashions. You're all welcome, Wisconsinite union members.
She's gonna be working the supper clubs.
Yeah, so the internet has been afire in recent weeks with discussion and ongoing litigation about the New York City mayoral race. And there are some upsides to this. Nobody's talking about the 2016 Democratic primary as much. Nobody's talking about the 2020 Democratic primary hardly at all. But instead, we are now talking about the 2025 New York City mayoral primary.
You just cracked that can, and we're going to get an entire deluge of it for the next week. Thank you.
Put it out there in the universe, brother. I don't know what you were thinking with that one, but it's done now.
Stop manifesting.
Well, okay. So, so Zohran Mamdani won the Democratic nomination, as you may have heard. And he won it in convincing fashion. He was a major underdog in the polling leading up to the election, and then he won it by, the final margin was, what, about 12 points?
Yeah.
Yep. Which was a shocking miss by the polls. Just one of the worst misses I can recall in a primary. There's reasons to think that miss was plausible, but it was a big miss.
Such as in our previous episode.
And despite the fact that Mamdani is the Democratic nominee, we still have a number of conservatives or moderates, depending on how you want to view them, in the race. Cuomo has declared that he is running.
And not just that, he's already produced one of the funniest campaign ads, not intentionally on his part, very much not intentionally on his part. One of the funniest campaign ads I think I've ever seen, where he helps this young man jump his car. I lived in Manhattan for 4 years, and the idea of owning a car in New York City was like the most implausible luxury you can imagine. It's equivalent to flying a private jet.
He also hooked the jumper cables up incorrectly.
Yes. Was he in the wrong order?
Yes.
Yeah, he did it in the wrong order. Now, to be fair, it's Andrew Cuomo, so I'm amazed he didn't hook them up to the wrong terminals.
Frankly, it's amazing he didn't hook them up to his nipples, but
he does rock the nipple rings, right? I've heard that. That's actually true. He's got nipple piercings.
It is true, and it's horrifying.
Oh, I'm looking that up in a private window.
Yeah, so Cuomo's still in it to win it. Eric Adams is out there doing whatever Eric Adams does. He's
fighting anti-Semitism. What are you talking about?
in between hunting for the leprechauns underneath the city.
Oh God!
Wait, how did I miss this entire discourse round in 2020? I guess other things were happening, but
sorry. By that discourse, you mean the nipple rings?
Yeah.
Cool.
Yep.
You gotta have a Google alert set up for nipple piercings.
I'll get on that.
Anyway, the Republican candidate, Curtis Sliwa, who runs for office pretty much every year in New York, is still in the mix also. The polling is thin, but it's pretty dire. I think it's a long way to go until the actual election, but it would take a lot of movement at this point for Mamdani to not be a near prohibitive favorite to win the mayoral office. But there are billionaires to grift off of, so into the breach Cuomo goes. Adams also carries forward the hopes of the city. And there has been a lot of focus on which Democrats have been willing to endorse Mamdani to date.
To be clear, inside New York City politics, the vast majority have endorsed or have, you know, at least not done a dance where it looks like they're not going to endorse. If you talk about actual municipal politicians inside New York City, the national politicians from New York state and city, little bit of a different issue there, a little bit of a different vibe coming off there.
Right. So there was a much anticipated meeting between the House Minority Leader, Hakeem Jeffries, and Zohran Mamdani on Friday, 2 days ago as of this recording, where there was widespread speculation that Mamdani was going to walk out of that meeting with an endorsement from Jeffries. He did not. People are drawing conclusions from and are having big feelings about that lack of endorsement. My personal view is that...
Sorry, Propter, can you do me a favor and just steel man for me? I don't know. We can talk about your view, and I'd love to hear what Lotax and Ed have to say about this too, but...
The lie detector determined that was a lie.
Can you just steel man for me why Jeffries shouldn't have endorsed Mamdani on election night of the primary? I mean, forget now, but like, what's the affirmative case for waiting for any reason?
I think it's pretty reasonable to wait until you have a chance to sit down and meet with the guy, but... One of the things that's kind of in the water here is that Jeffries is worried about a primary challenge in 2026. And I think there's some reason for him to be worried. This is a very anti-incumbent mood that it looks like we're headed towards for that election. And I think it's plausible that he could lose an election. New York is also talking about redistricting again. And the more vulnerable incumbents feel when we redistrict, the less we're going to be able to do in terms of aggression. So that's also another component. That said, at this point, you know, it's been a while. Jeffries has had an opportunity to meet with Mamdani. I'm not worried about it at this point, as long as he does endorse fairly soon. But at some point, he's got to endorse. You can't have somebody win the primary and not get the imprimatur of the highest ranking Democratic politician who happens to be in the same district. You know, this is basic party hygiene, where the person who wins the primary ultimately has to have everybody behind him.
It sort of feels like he's creating the grounds for a primary challenge in his effort to avoid one, right? I mean, I could totally see people getting pissed off enough about this that he ends up losing a primary that he would have won if he had just come out on election night and gotten behind Mamdani and said, great, awesome.
But the flip side is that, like, the rumors are also touching on that, you know, some of quote-unquote Mamdani's allies, for whatever you take that to mean, are threatening him, right? And do you as the leader of the Democratic Party in the House, do you put up with that?
There's very clearly bad blood between Brooklyn DSA and the Brooklyn machine, we'll call it vaguely. Brooklyn DSA's coalition is primarily young people and white professionals who live in Brooklyn. And the Brooklyn machine is primarily, not exclusively, older people of color. You know, DSA has won some rounds recently, which is kind of new. This is by far the part of the country where DSA has had the most electoral success anywhere. You know, going back all the way to AOC primarying out Joe Crowley back a few years ago, that was kind of a tectonic shock, because it indicated that this scene could actually produce candidates who could successfully challenge at the primary level.
And it's notable, too, that the coalition that Mamdani put together is not dependent to the same degree that Brooklyn DSA typically has been, right? Mamdani is a real threat to the Jeffries machine wing of the party, because his coalition is so much broader than the traditional DSA coalition. And it's also, ironically enough, and you can go back and listen to our episode with Detective Pikachu about this. You should if you haven't listened to it. But it is a coalition that can bust the machine, because it's the exact type of voters that everyone was freaking out about swinging to Trump in November of 2024. His marginal voter demographic that really punched above their weight are low info, probably non-white, Asian, Black, maybe Latino, younger, in these same neighborhoods that have not participated in the Brooklyn machine or in the various machines in big urban areas around the country, and therefore haven't been a factor. But when they actually do turn out, are turn out to be more numerous, and when combined with that white professional and younger DSA bulge, to knock out the machine. So, I mean, just in terms of self-preservation being the first law of nature, Jeffries is right to be worried. I'm just not sure he's pursuing the optimal strategy given that concern.
Well, can I mean, you never say DSA bulge again.
Thank you. I will talk about my DSA. No.
I think that that depends on what he gets out of these negotiations. I think that there are negotiations happening here. You know, the readout of this meeting on Friday was that Jeffries and Mamdani were going to get back together with a bunch of national New York polls and a bunch of local New York polls in tow to talk about next steps. That seems to me to be a move, because it's not sufficient to make peace between Jeffries and Mamdani, who are not directly in opposition. What you need to do is you need to make peace between the gangs here, essentially. You need to figure out some kind of either power sharing arrangement or some kind of truce where DSA and the machine are either not directly opposing each other, or they are directly opposing each other only in a limited way. If Jeffries gets that, if Jeffries avoids a primary challenge from DSA, then I think that's probably a win. To return to the steel manning for a second, I think Jeffries also believes, it's been reported, he said stuff like this, that Mamdani is going to be somebody who Republicans run against nationally. And he's worried about tying the fortunes of the National Democratic Party to Mamdani. I think that's kind of BS.
It certainly reveals someone who hasn't spent much time watching Mamdani videos on Instagram.
Yeah. I mean, like, the question is, how easy is it going to be to demagogue against Mamdani? If this is something where Fox is going to spin up the Wurlitzer and just trash him continuously for the next year and a half, you know, then that's maybe a problem.
But they're going to do that to anyone, right?
They
you could,
are.
You could hand right. a broom to somebody and they'd be like, that broom is made of foreign straw, right? Like, they will do whatever they can.
Right. The question is, how close do you want to be standing to the broom if you're Hakeem Jeffries?
Yeah, but also at the same time, also, like...
So, like, again, I don't think I agree with him on this, but that's the argument that he's allegedly making, is that there is national peril. And I mean, to be fair, like, Mamdani is definitely to the left of the center of the Democratic Party nationally. There's no question about that.
Yeah, but that doesn't matter. And I think that's the thing that the results in New York and the polling miss especially showed, is that the ideology, the valence of the ideology is very low. Right. Yeah. Which is something that I personally am frustrated by for a bunch of reasons, because I think if the valence of ideology was higher in our national politics, we'd have a very different national politics. The valence of ideology in our national politics is extremely low, and it has been for a long time in a couple different ways. And what the median voter that Jeffries' thoughts here, or the sort of the mental model you're ascribing to Jeffries, we clearly don't have his mental model, but I think it's a reasonable estimation. That mental model is dependent on median voters setting by ideology. Nope, they don't do that. They set on vibes, baby. And to be clear, that's not the typical voter in this country. There's probably 80% of the electorate that is ideologically valent, but they're valent and locked in, and there's nothing you can do to break that. The 20% that are going to swing around, they want the nice dude who looks like he's fun to talk to from Instagram. They don't care what Rupert Murdoch properties say about him.
Just remember, as our friend Michael Tay Sweeney always likes to say, the median voter thinks that the NFL commissioner is a cabinet position.
It's so true.
So one of the things is that, like, I Hakeem Jeffries' median voter could definitely be ideologically driven, but also might just be Schumerite, right? Like, the fiction in his head. And at the same time, I think you're right, George, because when you look at this sort of thing, it is absolutely like the apotheosis of, will you have a beer with this guy? And as much as short form video makes my gorge rise, he's good at it.
He's so good at it.
He is. It's amazing. But one of the things that really stands out to me is that, yeah, sure, Fox is going to demonize him, but they'll demonize anyone. On the flip side is, if they create any sort of curiosity, that median voter is as susceptible as anyone to just going and thank you to the almighty algorithm, accidentally getting, oh, wait, this guy's kind of normal, right? Yeah, he's to the left, but, like, he comes off as normal. And honestly, like, that goes back to, you know, DSA 101, please be normal. He succeeded, and like, that's because, you know, the end results are going to not necessarily skew the way anyone thinks, even if they are just assuming the median voter is 55 years old.
Normalcy works, folks.
Well, I mean, I think that's a place where Mamdani really does differentiate himself from somebody like a Brandon Scott, who's the mayor in Chicago, who was the leftist in the race, and who has become quite unpopular over the course of his mayoral tenure to date. Mamdani is just worlds better at media than Scott is, and that makes a difference. It especially makes a difference in terms of susceptibility to national demonization. That said, I think that the bull case for an eventual Jeffries endorsement is that this is tactical stuff that is related to the DSA machine turf war. The bear case is that he's legitimately worried about nationalizing the NYC mayoral race and tying that to the larger Democratic Party. That's the only avenue that I really see where I'm worried about him not endorsing eventually.
I think the one thing we can all agree on is that New York has to stop mattering so f***ing much.
I would appreciate it.
Yeah, I think Jeffries should endorse him, and then we should never talk about this race again until November, and that all of this is these two guys doing, well, not just these two guys, but all of New York political people measuring their dicks, and New Yorkers are, their politics is for perverts. you would never get this from California, because they're all from San Francisco. They've all slept together. Or if they haven't, they've at least slept with Willie Brown. And so they get along and they know how to keep their stuff right.
I can see it now. Speaking of keeping the stuff right, to just have the last 30 seconds of Low Tech Speed Run Enjoyer on air, finishing with Californians, a people with shame.
One Californian with no shame whatsoever. Gavin Newsom. Gavin Newsom.
I love it when a plan comes together.
Gavin.
It's not going to happen, Gavin.
Gavin
Just
Newsom.
Just stop this.
But his hair is so nice.
So Gavin Newsom wants to be president.
No.
I mean, who among us, right? Like, you're the governor of the sixth largest economy in the world. You think you can get the top job. I get it. But, buddy.
He's got a great podcast. No, he doesn't.
He looks like somebody took Mitt Romney's hair and put it on a ham.
Gammon Gavin, they're calling him, folks.
That's right.
Wow. Wish I thought of that.
The pros for Gavin Newsom right now in my book is that he's arguing strongly for gerrymandering for redoing the districts in California so that we squeeze another at least couple.
Oh, you mean gerrymandering.
Representatives out of California.
Good.
I mean gerrymandering. I mean, we're going to take it away from the Independent Commission, and we are going to paint that map as blue as it can possibly be. Which, if Texas does successfully gerrymander their districts and get even another couple seats out of that, which I'm still a little skeptical about their ability to do, will be just maybe a necessity for us.
To put a pin in this for just a quick second, we need to do an episode sometime about the dummy mander because it's one of my favorite phenomenons in politics. So we're not going to talk about it right now, but because we mentioned Texas doing a gerrymander to squeeze a couple more seats out, folks, remember the term dummy mander. We will return to it. Anyhow, Propter, you were saying.
So that's good in my view that he is being expressly partisan on a national level and he is doing so in a way that might actually do some good things. At the same time, he is unmistakably pivoting right on a bunch of social issues, particularly on trans rights, made a lot of people very angry. He seems maybe a little bit incoherent compared to kind of where the party is as a whole. It seems like he's tacking for certainly the conservative lane in the Democratic primary. I think it's an open question whether that lane fully exists at this point.
What I want to know is what is he doing in South Carolina? Because if he's going to tack in the conservative lane of the Democratic primary for president, and he doesn't have a blow your socks off game in South Carolina, or some sort of dump truck full of cash headed for Jim Clyburn's driveway, then he's dead in the water. You cannot win the conservative side of the Democratic Party, and small c conservative, of course, because really there aren't any Democrat conservatives left. But you can't win that wing of the party without huge numbers from black older voters. And that path is established through South Carolina. It's how we got Biden. Bernie lost the primary in South Carolina. It's going to be the same story in 2028, or if not South Carolina specifically, then that exact demographic.
Yeah, unless they significantly change the Democratic nominating process, it's very, very, very difficult to win it without putting up huge majorities.
I would say it's difficult to win the conservative path, lane. I think you can still win a Democratic primary nationally without black voters in the South, or without at least some margin there. But you definitely can't win the conservative lane without them, if that makes sense. And it's very hard to win nationally without them, or without at least decent margins there, if that makes sense.
This has been a subject of a lot of debate ever since 2008, with kind of the polling and maps community, because Democrats do a proportional split of their delegates, right? So like you get a fraction of the delegates that, and the formula is more complicated than this, but you get a fraction of the delegates that's related to the percentage of the vote you got in a state. What that means is that you get very, very little delegate gain if you're heads up against somebody, if you don't win by a lot. And the geography, unless things have really shifted in other states, the geography is such that the states where you get to win by a lot, if you have favorable demographics are the South. That's where you have essentially more of a monoculture in terms of what Democratic voters look like, because there are not that many non-Black Democratic voters in the South. That's our entire problem.
It's starting to shift. And North Carolina is a great example of that, right? The Black vote in the state is shifting away from Democrats, or at least margins are going down. And the Latino and independent South Asian white, that is where the growth is for the party in this state. So I don't think it's mathematically true anymore that you can just run the table with Black voters in South and win. It definitely, that analysis is 100% correct for 2020. I think in 2024, it's possible. You can't get completely taken to the cleaners. You have to win some of those votes, but you can do that and still be competitive. It's just really hard to do. If you can win Black voters in the South, it's the highest value play you can come up with of any demographic in the country as a Democratic presidential candidate, for sure.
So how do we think Gavin Newsom is going to play with Black voters in the South? Because I don't see it.
Having knocked doors with a lot of these folks, not that many, but enough that I got a feel for it. Boy, I don't know.
I mean, like Bernie's problem is that he's had like six Black constituents a lifetime. Gavin Newsom at least comes from a state where people of color exist. So, you know, he's got some amount of relationship to Black institutions in California. Whether that translates to South Carolina, I have no idea. He will have a ton of money. That I am sure of. But also, people just don't seem to like him very much.
The problem is, I don't like Gavin Newsom. I hate his stupid hair. Every time he opens his mouth, I cringe. His podcast is a train wreck. But he's also, he hates Republicans.
Fair.
And there is value to that right now. On the flip side, like, if you go look at any of the betting markets, AOC is right behind him. And I don't think that, I don't think that necessarily holds water, but third place on all of these is Pete Buttigieg, and I don't think he hates them enough.
No, I think he hates them.
If Gavin would just stop giving in to this transphobic bullshit and just stick to hating Republicans. You look good when you do that. You sound good when you do that.
He's so good at it.
You have very pretty hair.
Oh, now we've gone around on the hair.
Hating Republicans and pushing back on transphobia is the exact same energy. It's the exact same logic. It is the exact same mindset. It's the exact same understanding of the world.
Hell yeah.
It's that. I do not understand why it's not a natural position, because it's the same thing. It's punching up at the bully. It's
because they all listen to the very smart boys who are Republicans but pretending not to be. Hello, Matt Iglesias.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think if you look at the 2028 field, and we'll talk about the broader 2028 field in a minute here, we've got a lot of people who want to fight. We're not short on people who really want to bring the wood to Republicans. Pritzker, like, you can feel it when that guy talks. He wants blood and veins in his teeth.
My man came here to do two things: eat Chicago style hot dogs and hate Republicans, and he's all out of hot dogs.
You know, Tim Walz does not like Republicans. He's got some anger too.
Do you want to never, I mean, not that you do anyway, I'm going to preface this, but do you want a cast iron reason to never respect Polymarket ever again?
Hit me.
Yep.
Where do you think Pritzker is on the Democratic presidential nominee 2028?
I don't know, but it's below Mamdani, right? Who isn't eligible to run.
They're selling dollars for 5 cents on Polymarket right now.
So there's something like 30 choices on here. Where do you think Pritzker is?
I thought 25? It was 5%.
I gotta recuse because I actually know the answer on this one.
Not listed.
Holy crap.
Barack Obama is on there.
Oh my God.
Do they still have LeBron James in fourth?
I scrolled. I misspelled his last name. He is in the 20s with 2% of the pool. So he is above Barack Obama. I apologize for my grievous error, but he is below Michelle Obama.
He's below,
and Mark Cuban.
He's below Zoran Mamdani too, who is, as we all know, not eligible to be president.
Hey, that is a damned dirty lie, Mr. Speedrun Enjoyer. Zoran Mamdani is at least 10 spots below him now.
Oh, okay.
Now.
Yeah.
See, how dare he?
Mamdani was priced at 7% at one point, which is just, I mean, again, as someone that's not eligible to run for president.
Hey, he's right in there with John Stewart, Hillary Clinton, Roy Cooper, and Jared Polis.
Roy Cooper, nah. I was going to say it's not the dumbest idea, but nah, it's not going to.
Don't open that can.
Yeah. No,
it's not going to be Cooper. We're moving
on. Just go to LeBron. It's fine.
Yep.
Everyone else did.
You just can't let LeBron pick the people around him.
GM LeBron, no good.
Yeah, so where are you guys on 2028? Who do you like at this point?
I think we're 2 years away from anything that matters happening, and I think Mamdani's success in New York is a perfect example of why predictions at this point are a waste of time. I can tell you with great, great confidence that Zoran Mamdani will not be the Democratic Party's nominee for president in 2028.
Really?
And I would bet very large sums of money, if I had it disposable, to that Michelle Obama or LeBron James wouldn't be either. But beyond that, I mean, there's so much contingency. There's so much infighting. There's so much reaction to Trump between now and then. I don't think it's worthwhile to scrutinize it that closely. I do think Pritzker's got things to recommend himself. I do think Newsom does as well, for primarily the fighter reason. Don't like much else about the guy. But we're so far away. We're so far away.
George is no fun. I, on the other hand, am happy to go with wild predictions, though not quite so wild as LeBron James. I still think he has a couple years left in him. Pritzker is the fun one, but if we're being serious, I mean, I kind of think it's probably going to either be a VP, either Pete Buttigieg or somebody who was considered for VP last time around, which probably means Josh Shapiro.
Yeah, I think it's...
I do not say that positively, George.
Yeah, I think it's probably going to be one of the Rust Belt governors. Somebody like John Ossoff would intrigue me, although I really don't want to have to re-win that seat with somebody else. You know, we've got Reverend Raffi and such a nice boy, John Ossoff, in there. That's we're in a pretty good place in Georgia Senate wise.
You know, Warnock is the one whose term is up in 2028. He'd be an interesting candidate. I've kind of enjoyed how little attention the Senate is getting as a pool of candidates this time around. Nobody really seems to think it's going to be a senator, and I like that because I don't want it to be a senator. But a lot of time between now and then.
None of the senators really jump out at me.
No.
As I mean, other than Ossoff and Warnock. I think it's probably going to be one of Pritzker, Shapiro, or Walz.
The name recognition thing. I mean, like right now, any polls would be a proxy for name recognition. Right. But also, like, I do think you might maybe kind of need some of that going in. And I like John Ossoff a lot, but I don't know about that.
I honestly think if Stephen Colbert decides he wants it, he's got a lane. He's about to get canceled. He's gonna lose his show in 2026. He is, from all accounts, an extremely bright, extremely capable person. He has been involved in the business of politics for the last 20 years or so. Not from the lawmaking side, but he's got the kind of name recognition that we would love to have. He's very, very good in media. If you want a parallel to Mamdani, I would certainly vote for him in the general. I don't know if I'd vote for him in the primary, but
I have to ask, because that is an inspired pick. How long were you working on that half court shot? Because if that goes in, that is legendary.
I wouldn't mind Stephen Colbert running. I kind of think Stephen Colbert wouldn't do it because he has a level of humility about this that I don't imagine him getting over. Like, I think he probably believes that, you know, a governor, a senator, a former cabinet member, somebody like that should be the president and not, he'd probably sit there and tell you, look, I'm just some schmuck comedian on television. I shouldn't be running any of these things.
You can already just hear him saying, shouldn't you vote for someone qualified?
Yeah.
And to that I say no.